In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, Dr. John Marciano continues his public seminar series with Empire as a Way of Life, a monthly lecture and discussion presented until June of 2007. Dr. Marciano says about Empire as a Way of Life, "A fundamental purpose of our meetings is to understand the systemic nature of the U.S. Empire and the economic and military imperialism that is its lifeblood." The historian William Appleman Williams argues that empire became a way of life in the U.S., a combination of patterns of thought and action that, as it becomes habitual and institutionalized, defines the thrust and character of a culture and society. This way of life has convinced many U.S. Americans they have a right or manifest destiny to impose their political and economic policies upon others. The lectures are given at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Dr. John Marciano is Professor Emeritus, State University of New York, where he taught courses on social and historical foundations of education and class, gender, and race. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@mac.com.
Okay, Michael Parenti Against Empire, Part 2. Let me begin tonight by just repeating an important conclusion from the first half of Parenti's Against Empire. That is, U.S. imperialism, in his view, is not stupid and mistake-prone, but remarkably successful and brutal in the service of elite economic interests. He begins the second half of the book by examining what he calls the contrived reasons used to support imperialism. For example, defending democracy, protecting U.S. interests, fulfilling our responsibilities as world leader, and containing the threat of Soviet global conquest, which of course ended in 1991. But remember the date in this book, he was looking back. Another important pretext, he argues, is that our survival is often threatened by an evil adversary who is then demonized. Once the leading demon, of course, was Joseph Stalin, whose name was always raised whenever people challenged elite policies here. Parenti argues that this would lead the Cold Warriors in Washington to raise the specter of Stalin. After Stalin came populist nationalist leaders of the Third World, such as Nasser of Egypt, Gaddafi of Libya, and one of our favorites, Panama's Noriega. Finally, there was Saddam Hussein, demonized as the White House and the media revved up their propaganda war against Iraq in 1991. Saddam was called the Butcher of Baghdad and a beast. We now know that Saddam's best beast days, of course, occurred while he was on the U.S. payroll. But our media pundits and politicians did not bring up this earlier U.S. support after he became enemy number one in 1990, and of course he continued till very recently. These demonized adversaries were often accused of terrorism against the U.S. or its allies. At the same time, Parenti states, real right-wing terrorist acts and hate crimes within the United States by homegrown right-wing groups have caused hardly a ripple of concern in Washington. Using the terrorism card has always worked. By portraying itself as a champion against terror, the U.S. national security state deflects attention from its own international terror network. According to Parenti, the U.S. has invented various stories over the years to defend its imperialism and terrorism, a propaganda effort that essentially began in 1917 with the Russian Revolution. U.S. disinformation about that event laid the foundation for all future U.S. propaganda about anti-imperialist struggles and movements. When the U.S. and its capitalist allies invaded the USSR shortly after its revolution in 1917, citizens were first told it was necessary to prevent the Bolshevik government from aiding the Germans. Then President Wilson said the invading troops were needed to reestablish order and prevent atrocities. The truth, Parenti writes, is that the interventionists and their White Guard allies were causing most of the disorder and committing most of the atrocities. Finally, President Wilson admitted The real reason he could not abide the Bolsheviks. They were insufferable, Parenti argues, because they were avowedly anti-capitalist and a dangerous example to common people. Parenti jumps ahead and also critiques the official propaganda for the 1991 Persian Gulf War, or the First Gulf War, showing how lies and war go hand in hand. The first lie was that the U.S. forces were needed in the Middle East to defend Saudi Arabia from an impending Iraqi invasion. Then President Bush, the first, asserted he wanted to protect human rights in Kuwait and elsewhere in the Middle East. A third story held that the U.S. was upholding the U.N. commitment to defend member states against aggression. Then Bush claimed he was trying to prevent Saddam from monopolizing all the world's great oil reserves. Then the White House trotted out the weapons of mass destruction threat, immediately after opinion polls showed that Americans were worried that Iraq might be developing a nuclear capability. Bush the first and Clinton milked this weapons of mass destruction fabrication throughout the 1990s, and Bush the second took it to fantastical heights as part of the current attack on Iraq. According to Parenti, these false explanations were needed to get U.S. citizens to support the 1991 invasion. The actual and compelling considerations for war, however, included Hussein's effort to stop the Kuwaiti slant drilling into his oil reserves and as a promotional event for the military-industrial complex. The quick and easy victory was a promotional event for intervention itself, a cure for the Vietnam syndrome, that is, the public's unwillingness to commit U.S. forces to violent conflicts abroad. It's supposed to be a really bad disease to have, by the way, the Vietnam syndrome. And the ruling class in this country has made an effort since 1975 to cure people of this disease. Parenti also examines the links between the war on drugs and empire. This war did not arise through misguided policies, he argues, but from the national security state's role in the drug trade. He gives us a brief history lesson on the CIA drug war connection, including the use of mafia thugs to attack communist-led unions in Europe in the late 1940s. In return, they were given a free hand in the transport of heroin, much of which ended up in the United States. So the U.S. policy, in his view, is less concerned with fighting a war against drugs than with supporting the empire's eternal war for social control at home and abroad. The war on drugs, therefore, is a key part of the imperialist project. Parenti also critiques those who deny U.S. imperialist motives, that is, those who claim this nation has intervened in other countries for a number of worthy causes, such as discouraging weapons proliferations and carrying out humanitarian missions. These apologists tell us that the U.S. is a force for peace. But the truth is that U.S. arms manufacturers and the Pentagon have given us and the Third World a fantastic array of weapons of mass destruction. The U.S. also has thousands of strategic and tactical missiles armed with nuclear warheads. In a huge double standard, the U.S. claims to be opposed to nuclear buildups, but has engaged in a campaign that is applied in a politically selective way against countries it has wanted to destabilize, and we can certainly think of those. On the other hand, it has supported the development of nuclear weapons for those countries whose policies are congruent with those of the U.S. global empire, and we also know who they are. According to Parenti, U.S. actions abroad do not flow from a humanitarian impulse. He points out that most U.S. missions abroad are actually used to bolster conservative regimes, build infrastructures that assist big investors, and lend an aura of legitimacy to counterinsurgency programs. For example, he profoundly disagrees that U.S. support for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan was a good intervention. The real destabilizer was the U.S. national security state. Even before Soviet troops entered that country, Carter provided assistance to the rebel tribes against the Kabul government that attempted a social revolution that included programs in land reform, literacy, housing, and public health. Carter and Reagan spent billions of our dollars through the CIA to support privileged landowners and Mujahideen tribesmen, helped by our friends in Saudi Arabia. The U.S.-backed opium traffickers, who would eventually provide about half the heroin consumed in the U.S. and were the biggest exporters of opium. The intervention was similar to past actions in other third world countries to prevent egalitarian social change. And we know now, of course, after 6 years of war in Afghanistan, that the Taliban are back in power in a great deal of that country, and the production, which eventually ends up as heroin, has gone sky high. It's actually the greatest it's ever been. U.S. CIA interventions in Laos, Vietnam, Nicaragua, Mexico, El Salvador, and Haiti, among others, are also discussed to make Parenti's point about U.S. hypocrisy and violence around the world. He asks us to ponder a fundamental question. Why has the U.S. never supported social revolutionary forces against right-wing governments? Given his own documentation, the answer is simple and challenges the thesis that U.S. foreign policies are quite complex. Actually, they are not. And one would be hard-pressed to name a single foreign intervention that contradicts Parenti's assertion and thesis on this issue. The underlying nature of our dual political system that shapes particular imperial policies is then analyzed. He states that there is a public mythical system that we are all taught in schools, and then there's the actual system of coercive state power that protects the dominant interests of finance capital. This latter system, which surprisingly is not taught in schools or discussed in the press, reveals the contradictions between the government and the state. The government, in his view, deals with visible office holders, pressure group politics, special interests, and popular demands. He says the state has little, if anything, to do with popular rule and is the ultimate instrument of class power. The coercive institutions of the state, for example, the CIA, the NSA, and the FBI, exist simply to preserve existing class relations. The executive branch, the key institution within the state when it comes to empire, is also addressed. Within this branch is the most virulent purveyor of state power, the national security state that comprises the most critical military and intelligence agencies, of which the CIA is the key unit. This is something that we'll talk about in a few moments when we discuss Chalmers Johnson's views. Presidents who have supported the national security state have simply violated democratic governance with impunity. Although Parenti specifically addresses the lawlessness of the Reagan administration, all U.S. presidents, especially since post-World War II, but all U.S. presidents have broken international and domestic laws on behalf of imperial policies. While there have been some dissenting critics of specific U.S. policies, for example, around the wars in Vietnam, Central America, and now Iraq, Parenti tells us that critics of the national security state are a minority within Congress. Although there are a small number in the House of Representatives who have opposed the present U.S.-Iraq war by actually voting against the funding, but not one senator has done this consistently, not one of those representatives has challenged the premises and practices of the empire itself. Within the government, therefore, one cannot find the critique of imperialism presented by Williams, Grandin, Parenti, Chalmers Johnson, etc. In the end, Parenti's critique of empire rests upon his analysis of capitalism. We cannot understand the nature of this empire, therefore, unless we first understand the basic premises and practices of our political economy system. Its purpose, in his view, is not to build democracy or help working people or save the environment. Its goal is to convert nature into commodities and commodities into capital, to invest and accumulate, transmuting every part of the world into its own image for its own realization. This is the social reality we must confront, in Parenti's view. Now, there are a number of scholars, we've discussed many of them in this course, who have supported Parenti's basic argument. I'd like to discuss two of those this evening. That's Andrew Basevich and Chalmers Johnson. And Ken just happened to mention that Basevich, who is a Vietnam veteran who taught at West Point, who's professor of international relations at Boston University, and who's written two fine books, one called American Empire, the other The New American Militarism, who writes for The Nation, that Basevich's own son was just killed in the war. And certainly as someone who's a Vietnam veteran, that must be quite a bitter reality as a father and a veteran to deal with. So what I'd like to do is raise and revisit some of Basevich's assertions about the U.S. empire and U.S. militarism from his two books. We begin with his New American Militarism and a quote from one of the premier U.S. imperialists of the 20th century, President Woodrow Wilson. "We do not of deliberate choice undertake these new tasks." He was referring to the U.S. imperial role abroad, and he was writing in 1900 before he became president. "This role abroad which shall transform us. All the world knows the surprising circumstances which have been thrust upon us as if part of a great preconceived plan. We just couldn't help ourselves. This is merely a particular example of the general spin the U.S. presidents have given to imperialist ventures decade after decade." More recently, Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, in the late 1990s, put it this way: "If we have to use force, it is because we are America. We are the indispensable nation." Although Albright was an architect and apologist of U.S. imperialism, her rhetorical flourishes convinced even progressive citizens that somehow we are different, the exception to big power aggression. Basevich argues that Clinton and Albright were explicit in this point. The U.S. was the indispensable nation endowed by Providence with unique responsibilities and obligations. Republican leaders employed different language but endorsed the sentiment. Except among a crabbed minority on the far right and the far left, a concept of the U.S. shaping a global order in its own image evoked more satisfaction than complaint. In this course, you are being subjected to comments by a member of the crabbed minority of the far left. And don't forget it. The notion of an accidental empire doesn't cut it with Basevich, however, given that those who chart America's course do so with a clearly defined purpose in mind. That purpose is to preserve and, where both feasible and conducive to U.S. interests, to expand an American imperium. Central to this strategy is a commitment to global openness, that is, the creation of an open and integrated international order based on the principles of democratic capitalism, with the U.S. as the ultimate guarantor of order and enforcer of norms. In American Empire, Basevich also critiques the myth of the reluctant superpower that somehow just stumbled into a position of greatness and leadership. "Some nations achieve greatness," observed the historian Ernest May. "The U.S. had greatness thrust upon it." Basevich states that this view embraces the story of America's rise to power the way Americans themselves prefer to tell it and believe it. "This is the myth of America as the city on the hill, the exception to great power aggression, a nation with noble designs that often blunders in its effort to do good throughout the world. In this view, the United States, unlike other nations, achieve preeminence not by consciously seeking it, but simply as an unintended consequence of actions taken either in self-defense or on behalf of others." According to Basevich, in practice, the myth of the reluctant superpower reigns today as the master narrative explaining and justifying the nation's exercise of global power. And his point about its bipartisan nature bears repeating over and over again. Both parties and virtually the entire foreign policy elite in the United States tacitly share a common vision and conform in practice to a strategic consensus of long standing. This is not just a Bush thing. We must keep this in mind whenever we hear assertions of substantive differences between the two parties on foreign policy. As you may recall, in an earlier class, we discussed Pasevich's laudatory views on the anti-imperialist critique of two dissident, perhaps radical historians, Charles Beard and William Appleman Williams. Their critique warrants another visit. Beard's thesis was that the primary purpose of U.S. foreign policy was to advance capitalist class interests. Once we understand this basic purpose, it is easy to understand the radical critique of U.S. policies put forth by Grandin, Chomsky, Parenti, and others. Beard's analysis of the U.S. empire is similar to Williams. American leaders chose intervention abroad in order to dodge politically difficult decisions at home, decisions that might call into question the power and privilege of the propertied classes. In order to maintain this fundamental maxim, therefore, Beard pointed out that the dominant elements and their advocates in Washington had long since concluded that the domestic market alone would not satisfy their own class interests or the nation's requirements, which, of course, they thought were the same. The dominant elite thus needed to link its narrow class interests to that of the national security and to talk of grander and nobler designs. All of this ideological spin is necessary to get us to support the kinds of genocidal policies that Grandin describes in Empire's Workshop, especially in Latin America. Viewed in this light, Pasevich writes, exporting economic surpluses, otherwise known as the industrialist way of escape, constituted the overriding national interest. It was not simply a matter of making money, but of preserving long-standing arrangements for allocating power and privilege within American society. Pasevich also discusses William Appleman Williams' ongoing anti-imperialist influence, which he suggests has endured for one simple reason. U.S. foreign policy has vindicated Williams' views on the nature of government and empire, even though Williams was denounced by the Cold War apologists for venturing outside acceptable bounds in his criticisms of U.S. policy. Those who stay within these bounds, who accept the premises, can make very tough methodological criticism of policies. For example, as we now see with liberal and democratic criticism of the present U.S.-Iraq war, that is, it's not working. But the fundamental premises of the conflict or U.S. foreign policy itself are beyond the pale and cannot be challenged. For Pasevich, Williams' crime was to suggest, in the midst of the Cold War, that the U.S. entertained imperial aspirations and that U.S. foreign policy had aimed at building and consolidating an American empire. This major critique has stood the test of time and has shaped the radical analysis of U.S. imperialism consistently rejected by liberals and conservatives. Williams asked whether this nation is even possible without empire, since it had always relied on expansion, especially economic expansion. The short answer is no, as the critique of John Bellamy Foster and others in this course shows. Capitalism's nature propels it inexorably toward expansion and growth. It cannot live within its means, and political reforms designed to accomplish this are doomed to failure. I wish to close tonight with some reflections by Chalmers Johnson, taken from his trilogy of books on Empire and Republic, Blowback, Sorrows of Empire, and his just released Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. A depressing trilogy, by the way. I will revisit some arguments made previously in this course, as well as adding new material from two of these books. Johnson, a scholar in the history and politics of East Asia and a former CIA consultant during the U.S.-Vietnam War, offers a powerful analysis of the origins and true costs of our empire. In his first book, Blowback, Johnson set out to explain how exactly our government came to be so hated around the world. As a CIA term of trade craft, blowback does not just mean retaliation for things our government has done to and in foreign countries. It refers specifically to retaliation for illegal operations carried out abroad that were kept totally secret from the American people. This is a key point that Parenti also emphasizes. Secrecy is necessary for imperialism, given that the truth about what is done in our name might arouse public protests that would block aggression abroad. These illegal operations include the clandestine overthrow of government, the training of foreign militaries in the techniques of state terrorism, the rigging of elections in foreign countries, and torture or assassination of selected foreigners. Johnson reminds us that because these actions were, at least originally, secret, meant that when retaliation does come, as it did on 9/11, the American public is incapable of putting the events in context. Not surprisingly, then, Americans tend to support speedy acts of revenge. These moments of lashing out, of course, only prepare the ground for yet another cycle of blowback. After blowback, Johnson commenced research on the network of 737 military bases maintained around the world. That is, according to the Pentagon's own 2005 official inventory. So we really don't know how many. It's at least 737. Not including the Iraq and Afghanistan conflict, we now station over 500,000 U.S. troops, spies, contractors, dependents, and others on military bases located in more than 130 countries, many of them presided over by dictatorial regimes that have given their citizens no say in the decision to let us in. This research led to the second book in his trilogy entitled Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic. As our occupations of Afghanistan and Iraq turned into major fiascos, Johnson writes, discrediting our military leadership, ruining our public finances, and bringing death and destruction to hundreds of thousands of civilians in those countries, I continued to ponder the issue of empire. It became clear to him that the Bush administration was claiming and actively assuming powers specifically denied to a president by our Constitution. It also became clear that Congress had almost completely abdicated its responsibilities to balance the power of the executive branch. Despite the Democratic sweep in the 2000 election, I would rather call it a minor mid-course correction, it remains to be seen whether these tendencies can, in the long run, be controlled, let alone reversed. Johnson's lament raises an extremely critical point, especially for those who continue to believe that if we only elect enough Democrats and liberals and take our country back, I don't know when we had it, even get it back, but that's a different issue, the imperial presidency and policies of empire can fundamentally be changed. I hope that our journey through U.S. history has disabused people of this notion. Continuing with his analysis in Sorrows, Johnson argues that the U.S. empire is so huge that it staggers the imagination. It supports a military-industrial complex, university research and development contracts, petrochemical refineries and distributors, innumerable foreign countries, multinational corporations, investment banks, and advocates of globalization. What he says is a catchword that really means forcing all nations to open themselves up to American exploitation and American-style capitalism. For Johnson, the liberal Woodrow Wilson remains the godfather of those contemporary ideologists who justified American imperial power in terms of exporting democracy. We're always exporting democracy. Wilson, as you recall, stated that the world must be made safe for democracy. America, he explained, must fight for the rights and liberties of small nations, for a universal dominion of right by such a concert of free persons as shall bring peace and safety to all nations and make the world itself at last free. God, it just touches me. According to Wilson, these were pursuits we have always carried nearest to our hearts. What a guy. Author Greg Grandin in Empire's Workshop and other scholars in this course have detailed the record of Wilson's relentless imperialist aggression in Latin America, revealing the utter bankruptcy of claims that he was concerned about the fate of small nations or about democracy. In pursuing imperialist policies, Johnson argues, the most powerful tool of the Pentagon in promoting its image and protecting its interests from public scrutiny is official secrecy. Since the beginning of the Cold War, he says, the Pentagon has become addicted to a black budget way of life. All funds for the CIA were, and still are, secretly contained in the Defense Department. I'd rather call it the War Department, which it was called in 1947. They're secretly contained in the War Department's public budget under camouflage names. As the President, the Pentagon, and the CIA create new intelligence agencies, the black budget expands exponentially. Despite an imperialist aggression since World War II, built upon the foundation of unlimited taxpayer funds for overt and covert policies, the essential nature of the Empire Project must be hidden from U.S. citizens. Johnson points out that history tells us that an expansionist nation must at least attempt to disguise what it is doing if it wants to consolidate its gains. It must pretend that its exploitation of the weak is in their own best interest, or their own fault, or the result of ineluctable processes beyond human control, or a consequence of the spread of civilization, or in accord with scientific laws. Anything and everything but the deliberate aggression by a hyperpower. Arguing that even globalization policies must be seen within an imperialist context that cannot exist without a powerful military apparatus for subduing and policing the peoples who stand in its way, and an economic system for financing an expensive and largely unproductive military establishment, Johnson believes we need to examine the elaborate ideology of neoliberalism that has obscured America's international endeavors before the triumph of unilateral militarism, and to reveal how militarism has displaced and discredited America's economic leaders. In his analysis, Johnson links, I believe in a powerful way, the dominance of empire abroad and the imperial presidency to the destruction of democracy at home. He states, although tyranny may successfully rule over foreign peoples, it can stay in power only if it destroys, first of all, the national institutions of its own people. This will first begin with a state of perpetual war, leading to more terrorism against Americans. It will be followed by a loss of democracy and constitutional rights as the presidency fully eclipses Congress and is itself transformed into something more like a Pentagon presidency. Complementing the above, an already well-shredded principle of truthfulness will be increasingly displaced by a system of propaganda, disinformation, and a glorification of war power in the military legions. Finally, there will be bankruptcy as we pour our economic resources into ever more grandiose military projects and shortchange the education, health, and safety of our fellow citizens. What an up message. And there's more. Johnson's scholarship on empire finally brought him to Nemesis, which is the final book. I just finished it. Nemesis, in Greek mythology, is the goddess of retribution, who punishes human transgression of the natural right order of things and the arrogance that causes it. I would say that she is an eminently appropriate goddess, given the boundless arrogance of U.S. imperialism. Johnson states that he no longer doubted that maintaining our empire abroad would eventually undercut or simply skirt what was left of our domestic democracy, and that might, in the end, produce a military dictatorship or, in his view, far more likely, its civilian equivalent. The synthesis of huge standing armies, almost continuous wars, an ever-growing economic dependence on the military-industrial complex and the making of weaponry, and ruinous military expenses, as well as a vast bloated military budget, not to speak of the creation of his whole second Defense Department, known as the Department of Homeland Security, has been destroying our Republican structure in favor of an imperial presidency. Johnson's definition of Republican structure embraces what he calls the separation of powers and the elaborate checks and balances that the founders of our country wrote into the Constitution as the main bulwarks against dictatorship and tyranny. Of course, that republicanism did not include their own tyranny visited upon the original Americans, slaves, and the poor, who didn't gain a thing from these elaborate checks and balances. But they still wrote checks and balances in that he argues are relevant to governing a modern society. Johnson's conclusion in Nemesis is blunt and uncompromising. We are on the brink of losing our democracy for the sake of keeping our empire. Once a nation starts down this path, the dynamics that apply to all empires come into play. Isolation, overstretch, the uniting of local and global forces opposed to imperialism, and that's happening every day in Iraq and Afghanistan, and in the end, bankruptcy. As a form of government, imperialism does not seek nor require the consent of the governed. It is a pure form of tyranny. The American attempt to combine domestic democracy with such tyrannical control over foreigners is hopelessly contradictory and hypocritical. A country can be democratic or it can be imperialistic, but in his view, it cannot be both. Johnson believes that our political system has failed to prevent this combination from developing and may not be capable of correcting it. In his view, Congress and the judiciary have become so servile in the presence of the imperial presidency that they have largely lost the ability to respond in a principled and independent manner. Even in the present moment of congressional stirring, the book was finished at the end of 2006, there seems to be a deep sense of helplessness, which is what sometimes you feel after reading his three books. Although he is not confident U.S. citizens will choose democracy over empire, he hopes that our imperial venture will end not with a nuclear bang, but with a financial whimper. It appears highly unlikely, he argues, that any president or Congress from either party will begin the task of dismantling the military-industrial complex, ending the pall of national security secrecy, and the black budgets that make public oversight of what our government does impossible, and bringing the president's secret army, and that's what it is, the Central Intelligence Agency, under democratic control. He concludes in this last book by stating that Nemesis is already a visitor in our country, simply biding her time before she makes her presence known. And you know from your Greek mythology that the Greek gods and goddesses didn't fool around. I would argue that all of us would be well served to study Johnson's accurate and chilling analysis. From the creation of the National Security State in 1947, lying, secrecy, and presidential power have grown, aided by compliant and silent legislators, judges, media pundits, corporate officials, and of course, influential intellectuals in major universities. There are no effective checks on these promoters of empire, save for those that emerge from the people themselves, as we have learned from the U.S.-Vietnam War and the current wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. We cannot count on elected officials to mount any real challenge to the relentless violence put forth by imperial, democratic, and Republican presidents and their congressional enablers. Therefore, there is no progressive solution to be found within the premises and parameters of our one-party, two-wing electoral system. For example, I would argue there's not a snowball's chance in hell that a Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama will challenge the premises and practices of the national security state and empire. Just look at their speeches carefully. Their funding votes on the war, and their comments especially on a potential war with Iran. Anti-war activist Bruce Gagnon's May 7th counterpunch commentary captured my thoughts on mainstream politics and the systematic nature of empire. He was writing a critique of an editorial on the U.S.-Iraq war that appeared in his local Portland, Maine newspaper. It complements what I have argued about the nature of U.S. imperialism and especially liberal and democratic support for it. He said that the editor explained why the paper had decided to come out against the war in Iraq after long supporting Bush's shameful and illegal occupation. The editor, as the editor now, stated that the paper had not renounced its belief in American exceptionalism. We're still the city on the hill. I've withdrawn my support for the war, the editor goes on, for pragmatic reasons, not because my underlying worldview has changed. I believe we should use our strength as the world's only superpower with great caution, but I do believe we should use it. Our nation has a unique role in the world, and with it come unique responsibilities and unique privilege. Just go back to Thomas Jefferson. This is not a new argument. Again, we see the age-old appeal to the United States as the special nation. We are the chosen people. In other words, Gagnon responds, the editor supports U.S. empire and all that comes with it. The killing and domination of cultures are acceptable, but he's withdrawing his support primarily because this war has been mismanaged by Bush to the point where turning things around is impossible. The slaughter is simply not working out the way we expected it would. Gagnon is correct to assert that this is largely the Democratic Party position as well. This is not just a Republican position. The war is not necessarily bad, and the U.S. still has the right and responsibility to take out anyone that we decide should be eliminated. But it must be handled well so that world opinion and the American people do not turn against the policy. And the American people have turned against the policy for the wrong reason. The lesson to be drawn from his bitter condemnation of his local editor and the Democrats, in my mind, is clear. Had the war actually ended after the first 100 hours with a crushing victory for our troops, silence and collaboration would have been the order of the day, and the empire would have marched on. Make no mistake about that. Let's take a break.
John spoke of the Taliban being in power increasingly in the countryside in Afghanistan. And he also said in about the same breath that the heroin trade has increased. Now, when the Taliban was in power in the agricultural areas of Afghanistan and years gone by, they suppressed the heroin trade on principle. And it's not to be misunderstood that an increase of power of the Taliban in the hinterlands and the increase in the heroin trade. It's the others, it's the warlords and the other agricultural interests who are increasing the heroin trade in Afghanistan. If the Taliban were in power, the heroin trade would be considerably reduced, and the price in New York and Los Angeles would go up considerably.
A couple of things before we get into the discussion. Thank you for clarifying that comment. Okay.
Chalmers Johnson's conclusion, I disagree with his premise that we're about to lose democracy because I believe that we never had it. You know, it's very clear that the moment that the revolution was over, the repression began when in the people's history there were instance after instances of repression among the people, revolting for better standards or whatever. Remember, they were revolting and they were repressed by the state immediately. There was never anything called democracy. It's a little bone that we've been thrown and we take it and we, you know, I don't know, we caress it, but it never existed here. It's a little bone that we've been tossed by the elites, and I'm really sick of hearing that word.
What, bone or democracy?
Democracy. Bone, good. Democracy, no. I am so sick of it being thrown around. Let's define it. You know, what is it that we supposedly have that's so great, you know, that causes us to be in such straits that we're in? The majority of the country wants this imperial adventure over with, and it's not going to be over with. I mean, there's no such thing as democracy. Come on. So let's stop using the word and lay it where it really is.
A quick response. If you recall in Howard Zinn's book that he would argue, well, before the founding fathers and the first quote-unquote U.S. government began to attack those who were raising challenges to Washington, of course, there was the entire, we should have thought of this because our great leader was in Jamestown yesterday or a few days ago with Her Highness celebrating the 400th anniversary of the invasion of Jamestown. Before that, there had been repression and attacks on indigenous nations in what is now the continental United States. But Zinn also argues that real, measurable, democratic advances have been made in the United States in spite of the powers to be. And that's the other side, that's the resistance side of a people's history in terms of women's rights, in terms of workers, in terms of child labor, etc. That has not fundamentally changed the core of the system, but has widened real civic liberties for people. And that's been the dialectic or the tension in U.S. history. I'm actually planning to, I almost always do this, when I read a book that I enjoy, I almost always send an email to the author, and many times I get replies. And I'm planning to send a long email to Johnson and to say how much I've enjoyed his work, how much it's helped me, etc. But I would take issue with that point, that the notion that somehow we're losing something that in many ways we haven't had. In that sense, I would agree with you. And that's why I just get turned off by this notion that there's this big conference coming up, take our country back or whatever. So, but I think you need that. There's a subtle but important oppression and resistance themes. There are those themes in Zinn's book. And it's clear that there have been democratic advances in this country. This is not, for example, in terms of the issue of race in the United States, this is not the U.S. 1954, right? You just walk around and see where people stay in motels, in hotels, in restaurants, on beaches, where people of color simply could not be seen, were not allowed to go. Zinn would call that part of the democratic struggle, and I would agree with him, that is a positive thing. I don't grant that to the government. I grant that to the people who resisted the government. But
okay, Parenti is pretty thorough, mentions a lot of stuff. But in terms of the first Gulf War and some other stuff, he left out a couple of things. I'll just comment on them. He did say that in the first Gulf War that, you know, there was slant drilling, there was all this stuff that Saddam was sort of tricked into going into Kuwait. And he did mention that everybody was told that Saddam's forces were gathering on the Saudi border, and that was not true. I mean, we've got documents that prove that's not true. Now, he could have mentioned the thing about the babies in the incubators. He didn't really include that. But the other thing I wanted to deal with was Afghanistan. And he did talk about the Kabul government and the good things that they were doing. I'm sure there's some criticisms that some people would make of it, but they were doing some good things, and they had a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union. Now, I read somewhere, I think it was in Chomsky somewhere, about Carter supported covert actions inside Afghanistan, but also going over the border to provoke the Soviet Union, because it sounds like that we actually, you know, we were the people that were causing the trouble there, you know.
In Afghanistan,
yeah. Not that the Soviet Union was perfect, but.
Well, the Soviets eventually sent their troops into Afghanistan. There's no doubt about that. And there were certain absolutely repressive measures that were put in place by the government that was allied to the Soviet Union. But on the other hand, in terms of the point you're making, an interview, I think it was last year, by Zbigniew Brzezinski, in which he admitted that he advised Carter 6 months before the Soviet invasion to really move with CIA involvement in Afghanistan. So it wasn't this shock of the Soviet invasion, and it was an invasion. And of course, Johnson's argument that a lot of that was unknown to the American people. Of course, I assumed that the CIA was involved, and then you start piecing things together. And then if you remember, Carter pulled the U.S. team out of the Olympics in reaction to the Soviet invasion. This was terrible, etc., etc. And of course, this is just roughly the same period as the Iran hostage situation. But since we didn't know, most people in the United States had no idea that the CIA was involved before the Soviets went in, one couldn't make any kind of a rational judgment. And that's how he frames the notion of blowback, that it's not just things that we did, but the secrecy.
We worked with all the worst elements.
He'd probably say that's the ultimate, the ultimate blowback was 9/11. And of course, if you don't understand the context, it was a crime against humanity. It was an act of terrorism. Absolutely no doubt about that. It's a massive crime. The people responsible, there should have been an international effort through the UN to find those responsible. But as a number of you have read extensively on 9/11, to do that, of course, would have had to bring the Saudis on the carpet, the Pakistanis, etc., those groups that were supporting the Mujahideen, even though they're supposedly allies of the U.S. Kit, so tell us a little.
Well, I sent John this morning a piece that came on the internet from tomdispatch.com. But what Chalmers Johnson does in this piece, I've been looking for it. I can't find it exactly, but I think I remember him saying that the only thing that will help in the current situation is action outside the government, because the government is all implicated. These people in the government are all part of the problem. And he's not advocating revolution, but he is advocating a massive social movement about comparable or even stronger than that occurred in Vietnam, the anti-war movement that had a big effect on stopping the Vietnam War. So he sees that as a ray of hope, apparently, if I'm remembering it right. I couldn't find the passage in here, but anyway, that's it. And that would be in line with what people like Zinn and Chomsky have been saying. We need movements. And Zinn goes on to point out that what has brought progressive change in this country in the past have been massive social movements. The civil rights movement you were pointing to, John, but then the women's movement that brought, the vote and so on and so forth, and the workers' rights movement and all that. So going on that kind of comparison, maybe that's something that we can look to for optimism, try and generate it and all that. Maybe there's a ray of hope there.
And I think that, we would be just sort of pie in the sky if there wasn't any real evidence of those movements in U.S. history. And there have been those movements. There have been those movements. This is not a question, we're just romanticizing, but those movements have occurred. But the key is social movements outside the official channels of government in the United States at any level. All right. Now, there are people within the government who we know now more and more because they're starting to write books, who had serious misgivings about the war. There were a few people, I believe it was three people, who were lower level officials in the State Department who actually resigned when the U.S. went to war in March 2003. But that is so rare. For example, we're having these revelations now by Tenet, okay? Who's on the he's on the circuit, he wrote this book, I've just, read excerpts. But Tennant and people like him have never pulled off a Daniel Ellsberg, all right? Where Ellsberg, of course, he and Tony Russo copying 7,000 pages of the Pentagon Papers and then liberating it, facing imprisonment, etc., to allow the American people to see that every single thing that we had been told about the Vietnam War was essentially a lie. Virtually no one inside government acts as a real whistleblower on these issues, which means you cannot expect the changes and challenge to certainly the empire and the wars to come from within the government. And that, inevitably you're saying, that seems to be Johnson's argument. So that means it has to be a broader social movement of citizens at every level, and that doesn't mean necessarily in the streets, but at all different levels of involvement. And that helped to make a difference during the Vietnam War. The real key, of course, was the Vietnamese first, and second, the total deterioration of the United States ground combat forces in Vietnam. And an article by Colonel Robert Heinel in the 1971 Armed Forces Air Force Journal said the Army was essentially as near to collapse as the French Army was in World War I. So that's what really ended the Vietnam War. those of us who were in the streets and doing those kinds of things certainly helped in that mass movement. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know whether the elements are there for that kind of movement, but I would agree that that's where it has to come. I would say that since none of us have a crystal ball here, we can only go on what's happened in the past. There has been no movement within the Congress, the judiciary, and the executive branch of the United States to challenge any of the premises of U.S. imperialism, not in any administration in U.S. history. And I would defy you to show me evidence that contradicts that claim. It just hasn't happened, and it did not happen during the Vietnam War. Congress did not vote to stop funding for the Vietnam War until the Vietnam War was officially over after January 27, 1973. It took 113 funding bills to do that. So, you know.
The discussion gives me a number of thoughts that I'm not sure what sequence to say them in, but one of them is that Howard Zinn, you say, points out that things are better in many ways than in 1954. I think that's true, but there's no mention of one of the things that is part of the trend and puts a restraint on U.S. imperialism and is the reason why we haven't been more quote-unquote effective in quote-unquote winning the war in Iraq, and that is that there's no way the government's going to reinstitute the draft. That's an important development, I think. It shows that it is possible to put restraint on the government's tendency to be imperialistic. But, you know, the whole discussion is pushing me more toward my libertarian friends, because I think that view is more accurate than the view that this particular government is terrible and has just black motives. The libertarian view is every government is terrible and have black motives, and they all tend to be terrible, and so you got to watch them like hawks. In fact, I mean, you have to do everything you can to keep power away from the government. One of their preferred ways is to just strangle it by giving it no revenue. That's one approach. But I think that that's a much more correct view, that every government tends toward tyranny. I mean, I think that the Hayekian view in The Road to Serfdom is very compelling and is better than the idea that one particular government is just terrible. If only we had the right kind of government, everything would be great, because that is clearly not right. So,
well, after Charles, I'll respond.
I wanted to go back to Naomi's comment a little bit, and well, two things. One is that in order to successfully push culture in a different direction, you have to be able to understand the mechanisms that are in place, how it is the culture is presently being manipulated, and how you can choose to make actions that will provide an impetus in a different direction that won't be able to be counterbalanced by the powers at their disposal presently. And I think the end justifies the means versus there's no difference between the ends and the means is key in this point. And another thing that occurs to me is that democracy at its best is the tyranny of the majority, and that especially if that majority can be uninformed, then it is something that's easily manipulated. So what perhaps we need to unite around is some kind of a consensus that recognizes equal rights when they're in the minority and also recognizes our situation being more than just stewards of citizens of a state, but occupants of a planet, because if we can't make those two come together in our minds and practically in our policies, then we suffer not just serfdom, but annihilation at our own hands, be they our own physical hands or somebody else's hands who's using us to kill off our land base and capacity to sustain life. So I think it's key to take a look at the mechanisms that are in place and how they're being used right now. We have to understand that first before we'll be able to unite around policies or I don't know, I don't want to use the word philosophy because it sounds a little bit out there, but basically an approach that can be successful in moving the world into a more harmonious position than it's at presently.
I must say, I piece these two comments together, but a quick response to each. To the libertarian notion, I think that a healthy distrust and skepticism, and here we're talking about the U.S., but certainly some of the things you've said transcend the United States, that absolutely healthy distrust of some of the tyranny that's built into this system, and a number of constitutional scholars would argue has been built in since the founding of the country, which is Parenti in one of his books argued why there's this incredible reverence for the founding fathers. If you really go back and read their works and actually study what they did come up with in Philadelphia, one would be incredibly skeptical from the beginning. It was an amazingly limited notion of democracy that left out virtually the entire society. And that's why I argue, following Zinn, that from that very limited notion of democracy, people have resisted and fought to widen even the basic forms, just even voting rights and other basic liberties, without challenging the core of this system. As to the problem is, we're caught in a situation in the world that we live in where we have to somehow come up with the mechanisms to govern ourselves as a people within nation states and within the world community, or, Charles, as you pointed out, there's no possible way to arrive at any harmonious understanding and amelioration of the problems that we face, war, poverty, environmental degradation, etc. Because the notion of some kind of perfect system simply as human beings does not exist, has not existed, and I would argue will never exist. So within those limitations, how do we govern ourselves in order to deal with the issues that Parenti and others have raised in terms, and here we're talking specifically about empire and wars. And again, to jump ahead to Chalmers Johnson, this government, which is the one we have to deal with, and I would say the government, the state, the regime, we've had different governments or different administrations. I would argue we've had the same regime since 1789. I mean, it's had different people, different forms. It has changed. It has been forced to change. As I said, I think any objective reading of American history would suggest that. Unless we are able to stop a system that is going to give us endless wars, the worst dystopic images that you can conjure up from literature, 1984, the kind of fictional images you saw, some of us saw in Blade Runner, that's what we're going to be facing. And it's going to be compounded by the things, Charles, you raised, that is the environmental degradation that may actually turn this society and other societies. Probably the most dystopic would be the Mad Max trilogy, which I think is about the most violent films I've ever seen in my life. As you remember, the post-apocalypse Australia films by George Miller, a former physician who gave us those films and also gave us Babe. I mean, wow. I actually like Babe a lot better than Mel Gibson. But as you remember some of those scenes, that it was just absolute, you know, people would call it anarchy. It wasn't anarchy. Anarchy was not the free association of people coming together. But that's the future that endless war and limited resources are going to produce unless we somehow get a hold of it. And that means some kind of government, some kind of ability of people to make decisions that affect the common good.
The group that survived in the first one was not the individual Mel Gibson playing the loner.
Right.
He finally joined the large communal group that survived together and went off to survive, made it to the shore.
Right.
So the whole thing there was you're not going to make it as a lone wolf.
But it had scenes of the most awesome violence that, oh, I guess you're up next.
Yeah, I would like to talk about how I feel about reading Parenti's book. And I found it a real downer. It was depressing. It made me angry and cynical. Because his entire book is dedicated to how the U.S. prowls the world to plunder and crush the third world people, and these are people who want to empower themselves to improve their quality of life. And as I was reading the book, I began to observe that there seems to be a lot missing in this book. Then I looked at the publication and saw it was 1995 it was written. or published. And so I said to myself, wait a minute, there's been a lot happening in the last 12 years. In addition to that, there's one sentence in the whole this whole bummer diatribe that gives me a reason for hope. And this
where are you? What page?
Page 66 in the middle of the book. And this
now, students, would you all turn to page 66?
And it made me feel better. It might give you some hope too, Naomi. Yeah, he said, in response, I would agree that the elites try their best to monopolize policy and mislead the public, and too often they are successful. Yet it should be pointed out that almost all policy that is worthwhile, life-affirming, and democratic in its substantive output has come from the people. So then I began to think of all the changes that have been happening since 1995. Back in 1995, I don't think 1% of the Americans knew anything about the WTO, the IMF, GATT, NAFTA, the World Bank, or the FTAA. And then, in 1999, what happened? We had the battle in Seattle, and that changed everything, I feel. That demonstration scared the hell out of the WTO that they had, that, and subsequent demonstrations in Cancun and Europe and Asia, that they had to go hide in the Rocky Mountains of Canada to do any business or go off on isolated islands and oceans to do any business. They also, I think the battle in Seattle caused divisiveness within the WTO, where even third world countries now are challenged the policies of the industrialized countries. Now, when Parenti published his book in 1995, almost all of South America was ruled by these comprador lackeys who would kowtow to the U.S., and today, almost all these countries are led by leaders who are against the neoliberal economic policies of the United States Republicans. To start with, there's Kirchner in Argentina, who basically told the IMF to go to hell because he was not going to pay them back. And then there's Evo Morales in Bolivia. He has nationalized Bolivian industries and distributed land back to the peasants. He's kicked out Bechtel, who controlled the water rights in Bolivia, and given them back to the local people. Rafael Correa in Ecuador. He's also renationalized industries and defied Wolfowitz at the WTO by not privatizing businesses that the WTO told him to privatize. Lula in Brazil and Bachelet in Chile. They haven't been as aggressive as these other two, but they certainly are no compradors. And then there's my favorite, Hugo Chavez. And he, who just last month in April, told the world that he's paid back $3 billion to the WTO or the IMF, and basically told him to go to join the devil in the White House. And also, he has announced that he's going to form his own form of the WTO, or the IMF, called the Banco del Sur, which is going to aid any country that needs aid. Daniel Ortega's been back in Nicaragua. And what's his name? That leftist in Uruguay, who used to be a former radical. I don't know his name right now. So ironically, I think that the quagmire in Iraq has been very beneficial to the people of South America. Because I'm certain, had it not been for Iraq, that Bush would be down there destroying every single one of these leftist countries. And on top of that, I've talked about Fidel Castro before. I'm very reticent about giving hero status to a dictator, but this guy comes close, because he may have not been successful in his revolutions in South America, but he certainly provided an inspiration to thumb your nose at the Yankee imperialists, and he has provided hope for these people that they might not have come about. And I don't know if these revolutions or these democratic revolutions in South America would last, but I feel that the United States has gone beyond the point of no return in regaining the power they once had throughout the world, especially all the chaos they've made in the last 50 years, just like the British will not be able to regain the power they had 150 years ago. That's it.
Well, thank you, Hans. How does one follow that? It's interesting. I mean, first of all, that it's more than appropriate, of course, for any response to talk about our gut feelings, our psychological response to bummer material. But then as you listed these changes, in a sense, you shouldn't be depressed, given the history you've laid out. At the same time, to widen this history a little bit, and of course, Michael Parenti, whom I know, has written these kinds of books for years. He's not this way in his personal life, and, you know, as I said, if we could get him here, maybe we'd even get him to sing a few Neapolitan love songs, even though he's Sicilian background. If you take that 10, 12-year timeline, laying out the assault that he argues that the U.S., and let's remember going back to William Appel and Williams, if Williams and Grandin and Parenti and Chalmers Johnson's arguments are correct, it's not the U.S. as the U.S., it's often a smaller group of people making policy that many of us don't know about, which is then rubber stamped even by congressional people who don't know about it, acting on behalf of us as the United States. And so therefore, the resistance to it is very difficult. So internationally, in the last 12 years, especially in South America, and I believe that's one of the arguments that was in Grandin's book, that the U.S. being tied down in Afghanistan and Iraq has made it easier for efforts, reformist, more radical efforts, especially in South America, to move. One, I could not imagine if this were the early 1970s in the period of Chile that the United States clearly would not have somehow subverted or assaulted or destroyed the Bolivarian Revolution in Venezuela. Now, we know that the CIA has people in Venezuela and in Bolivia. I mean, on a $35 or $40 billion, those are the estimates thrown around, they got a lot of people out there. So things have changed. And even the comment that you read from him in terms of the changes made in terms of women's rights, the civil rights revolution, etc., that positive, powerful things happen that then government came in on. I think when we were in the Zinn group, I said, Lyndon Johnson does not get up before Congress in March or April 1965, around the time of the Selma March, and say, we shall overcome without decades of struggle led by black people in the South and black people dying and thousands being arrested. Then the government was pushed. Kennedy was pushed after things happened in the South. I mean, just read the history. Read Taylor Branch's 3-volume history of the civil rights movement that's centered around King, Parting the Waters, I forget the 3 volumes. So things have changed in many powerful ways for people. Yet at the same time, not to balance your, you should be dancing on top of the table given what you said. Because I go through the same, you know, reading this stuff and thinking about things and talking to a number of you and saying, this has been going on decade after decade in my parents' generation and my grandparents' generation and people before anybody came in their generation. And the struggles of indigenous people, I mean, think about it as a 500-year struggle. I am just now reading the first book in the People's History of the World series that has just come out from the New Press. It's called A People's History of the Darker Nations by Vijay Prashad, who teaches at Trinity College in Connecticut. And it is absolutely stunning. Think of a Zinn book taken to the world and talking especially about the Third World, because he talks about the rise of the non-aligned movement and the Bandung Conference in 1955 and the amazing struggles against colonialism and imperialism in Africa and Latin America. But then he writes very powerfully about every single one of those movements being crushed, becoming corrupt in Africa, the nations crushing their own dissident forces, ending up in one-party states. And so there was an amazing movement that triggered often by Cuba in the late 50s, and loads of those things that happened that then have absolutely been reversed, and so that the conditions in Africa today are far worse than they were 40 years ago. And so when you take a longer view of that, the effort will be to how do they solidify these positive gains in South America to avoid what has happened elsewhere in the world. And that's the struggle. That's the struggle. And that's where the hope comes from. Because people have made a difference. I mean, you know, especially for those of us who were involved in the civil rights movement and who read about it and saw it, hey, and people's lives were changed within the system, but they were changed for the better.
I don't want to spoil this festive moment. So I was just going to mention that the U.S. foreign policy has never been a secret in those countries where foreign policy was applied to.
Right.
So we all knew what was going on and who's behind what was happening. I think the rhetoric of the Cold War gave some level of legitimacy to these policies. freedom against tyranny and so forth. And because of the appearance of logic in this argument, you could have, for instance, Walter Cronkite on television talking about the news. Today, that's gone, and people like Cronkite cannot justify this anymore. So we have people like Sean Hannity, and these are the guys who they basically have to shout out because they cannot justify what's happening. So maybe we are moving in that direction that the U.S. people cannot be fooled anymore as easily as they used to, and maybe they get to know what we have known ever since these policies were applied to us.
Thank you for that comment. I mean, even though our focus is on the U.S., given our readings and discussions, thank you, dear friend, for reminding us that we are talking about worldwide issues and things that were kept secret from many people in the United States. Of course, were not secret for the people who were the victims. I mean, you think back, many of us, to the Vietnam War, and how it was absolutely outrageous to think that people would leak secrets that the United States was bombing Cambodia and Laos for years that no one knew about, including, by the way, some generals in the United States Strategic Air Command. But the people in Cambodia and Laos knew they were being bombed. The real enemy was people in the United States. We were the ones who were not supposed to know. And a number of people have argued that the reason is that no matter how deep our conditioning is, that if many of these things were known, it would make a difference. It would make a difference. So they have to keep things secret. That's Ellsberg's argument about the Pentagon paper. You had to keep this stuff secret. Otherwise, people say, wait a minute, these guys are running for office. Johnson says we're not going to have a wider war in Vietnam, and Goldwater's a total lunatic. He wants to have a war in Vietnam. And did we know that Johnson was already expanding the war in Vietnam? Well, of course, we didn't know that. So a number of us, some of us, you're looking at one the first time you voted for Lyndon Johnson. Yeah, part of the way with LBJ. Yeah, I remember.
Oh, Hans, I loved the book, and I'm not the press. I felt like I was speaking with a friend who could really put my thoughts into words, you know, put it down on paper and rationalize everything that I think. It was beautiful to me, and it doesn't depress me. However, I think that if we really want to make a dent in this empire, that we may have to put our lives on the line, unfortunately. You know, look at what happened in the park, just, you know, the repression is so constant. As far as the analysis of empire, you say nobody's really challenged that. The systemic problems, I disagree. I think that the groups that gained the least from the empire have always challenged it, and they have to be repressed the harshest, and that's the American Indian movement and the Black movement, because they were the greatest victims of empire. I think they've always challenged the system, and they've had to be crushed, you know.
Well, to clarify, and maybe I'll give myself the last word before we go to Izzy's, but I did not mean to say that no one has challenged the assumptions of empire in this society. I meant, and it's in my notes, that is, those within the government, and I would depart from probably Johnson and even Parenti, in terms of those who are now within the Congress of the United States and the official branches of the U.S. government. There is no one that I know in his or her writings, public speeches, who has challenged the assumptions of this imperialist system. They have voted against particular wars. They have made speeches. Robert Byrd is always making eloquent speeches, and he always votes for the money to continue the war. Watch their feet, not their mouth. Watch where they go, not what they say. This is it. We'll leave that as the final word for tonight.
You have been listening to Empire as a Way of Life, a lecture and discussion series given by Dr. John Marciano. This group meets monthly until June of 2007 at the Ken Edwards Center in Santa Monica, California. Paper and email copies of the lectures are available. Contact Dr. Marciano at johnmarciano@macmac.com. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the Internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.